There was a time when you couldn't read a newspaper or watch the news without hearing about a plane being hijacked, usually to Cuba. Brendan Kerner recounts this period in aviation history in his book, The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. He told Doug Gordon all about it.
From 1961 to the end of 1972, there were actually 159 hijackings in American airspace. Most of those, about 130 of them, took place between 68 and the end of 72, often at a pace of more than one a week, sometimes more than one per day. So it was really a common thing, an almost everyday thing for stretches there. And it's really hard to fathom right now, and that hijacking to us is so terrifying.
Who were these skyjackers? Did they have anything in common?
This was a real challenge when I was researching it because they all came from very different backgrounds. They all had very different stated motives. You had disgruntled veterans. You had people with political reasons. You had the mentally unstable. You had pure criminals. It was very hard to draw a common thread between them all. But the more I looked at it, I realized that these were all people who were very desperate, who had been kind of cornered by circumstance and felt they could only do one thing to change their lives radically in one fell swoop. And that was hijack a plane.
And nearly all of the skyjackers asked to go to Cuba. Why did they want to go there?
Yeah, it's really interesting. This was the longest and really first phase of the hijacking epidemic. And this was people wanting to go to Havana. This was shortly after the Cuban Revolution. So I think people didn't quite know what to make of what Cuba would become. And I think there was a lot of belief that Castro really was establishing this kind of classless workers' paradise down there. And a lot of people idolized him and really believed that there was something promising and different down there. And when they got there, of course, the reality was quite the opposite. In fact, Castro wanted nothing to do with these American hijackers. He was very suspicious of them, thinking they might be CIA operatives. And he imprisoned many of them.
Yeah. It was surprisingly easy to hijack a plane back at this time compared with what we have to endure these days. Airport security was very lax back then, maybe even non-existent, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think non-existence really the operative phrase. It's hard to fathom, as you say now, the gauntlet we have to deal with getting on planes today. But back in the late 60s, you could literally walk from the curbside outside the terminal, through the terminal, onto the tarmac, to the top of the boarding stairs, and sometimes even onto the plane without having a ticket, without showing anyone identification, certainly without having anyone check your luggage or your body. So it was very, very easy for hijackers to bring weapons onto planes.
Mm-hmm. So the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, created the Special Anti-Hijacking Task Force to come up with possible solutions. And the task force received thousands of letters from citizens with their own ideas. What kinds of things did the people suggest?
A lot of them are pretty off the wall. A lot of them had to do with, you know, arming stewardesses with tranquilizer darts.
Oh, boy.
Putting trap doors outside cockpits and trapping the hijackers in plexiglass cages in the hold of the aircraft. A few of the more outlandish ones, there's one person who suggested making all the passengers wear boxing gloves, and that way you can't hold onto a gun if you have a boxing gloves on your hand, or playing the Cuban national anthem before takeoff, and then if anyone knows the lyrics, don't arrest them immediately.
That presumes, of course, that any Cubans on the plane are people familiar with the Cuban national anthem or are going to not be savvy enough to refrain from singing along, yeah.
Not the most ingenious idea. The one that was taken quite seriously by the FAA, actually, was to build a fake Havana airport in a field in South Florida. And so what you do is you would fly the hijackers kind of out over the water, then make a sharp right turn and go back to Florida and land and say, hey, congratulations, you made it to Cuba, and then arrest the hijackers getting off the plane. And that was actually dismissed as being too expensive.
What security measures did the American government implement to try to prevent the hijacking of planes?
Prior to searching people, they wanted to come up with something that was very non-invasive. They wanted something that the airlines would accept and not rebel with their lobbyists over on Capitol Hill. So they came up with this behavioral profile. It's basically a checklist of 25 behavioral cues that are supposed to indicate if someone might be a hijacker. And these are things like not maintaining appropriate eye contact, not knowing enough about your luggage or caring about your luggage. Wearing army surplus gear was one of them. And what they did is they trained ticket agents to know these tip-offs, and then it was responsible of the ticket agents to give passengers the once over when selling them a ticket or giving them a boarding pass. And then if someone fit one of these characteristics, then that person could be beckoned aside and briefly searched physically by a security officer. It was supposed to apply to about 0.5% of all travelers.
Was it effective?
It was not effective at all, actually. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that I think the jury's really out on how indicative these behaviors are of hijackers. Many times people were screened and passed with flying colors and were not searched and turned out to hijack the plane. The other problem with it is that having ticket agents do this, ticket agents are overwhelmed as it is. I mean, they're dealing with hundreds upon hundreds of harried, sometimes verbally abusive customers every day. And for them to add on security agent on top of this, to someone who's really not trained in that, it's not a very reliable way of making safer flying.
Yeah. You focus much of your attention on Roger Holder and Kathy Kirko. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, sure. So Roger Holder was a Vietnam veteran. He'd served in the Army. He'd actually done 4 tours. And at the tail end of his time in Vietnam, he had been arrested for smoking marijuana in Saigon and had become really irate over his punishment over this. He was sent to the stockade for a while and then demoted in rank. And had a clash with his commanding officer, was sent back to the U.S. as punishment, and then went AWOL. And was living in San Diego, where his family was living. His dad was in the Navy, and he meets this young woman, Kathy Kirko, from a small town in Oregon called Coos Bay. And she's working in a massage parlor in San Diego. And they meet, and they fall in love, and they become infatuated with one another. And at the same time, Roger is plotting something to do with his life that will make clear his feelings about the way he'd been treated by the Army and some certain rage had been boiling up inside of him over some childhood issues as well. And he decides he wants to hijack a plane to liberate the imprisoned black radical Angela Davis, who was then on a murder conspiracy trial in San Jose, California. So he decides he wants to hijack a plane, exchange the passengers for Angela Davis and about $3 million in cash, and take both the cash and Miss Davis to North Vietnam, where he would hope that Miss Davis would be given asylum and he could donate the cash to the Viet Cong as a sign of atonement for his involvement in the war. And he decided he wanted his girlfriend, Kathy Kirko, to come with him and do this.
So how did Holder and Kirko hijack a plane? What did they do?
When the plane was en route from Los Angeles to Seattle, and about 25 minutes before touchdown in Seattle, Roger Holder went to the rear of the plane. It's a Western Airlines Boeing 727 jet. And he handed a stewardess 2 notes, one saying that this was a hijacking and that he was affiliated with the Weathermen, the radical organization, and another note that was a diagram that showed a bomb inside a briefcase. And in fact, he was holding just such a briefcase with a length of copper wire with a ring on it that was around his finger.
Did it really have a bomb in it?
Did not really have a bomb in it, no.
He wanted to be flown to North Vietnam, right?
He did, yep. He wanted Angela Davis, he wanted $3 million in cash, and he wanted to be flown to North Vietnam.
The plan changed, though, right?
Yeah, well, there was one big error that he made. He hijacked the wrong kind of plane. A Boeing 727 is a very short-range aircraft, and certainly can really not get to Hawaii, let alone to North Vietnam, even with refueling stops. He needed a new plane. The second complication was that Angela Davis wanted nothing to do with this plot.
So what happened to Holder and Kirko when they landed in Algeria?
In Algiers, the reason that Roger Holder picked that was pretty interesting. At that time, there was a small Black Panther commune led by Eldridge Cleaver, the exiled Minister of Information for the Panthers and notably the author of Soul on Ice. He had fled the U.S. after being charged with attempted murder over an incident, a shootout that had occurred in the Bay Area, and was living there with a small group of followers and as well as his family. And Roger wanted to join that commune. And in fact, the Algerians at that time were a very anti-American regime, I think some similarities to Venezuela today. And they gave him and Kathy Kirko a political asylum there and let him crash with the Panthers in Algiers.
Did Kirko and Holder get to hold on to the money?
They did not get to hold on to the money. The Algerian government seized the money.
How long did Holder and Kirko stay in Algeria?
They stayed there for about a year. At this time, the commune was kind of falling apart. There was a lot of disputes between Eldridge Cleaver and the Algerian government over money and some other matters. Eventually, the commune fell apart and people scattered all over. The Cleavers went to Paris, and that's actually eventually where Holder and Kirko went as well.
And did they ever stand trial for the skyjacking?
Well, it's a complicated question. I don't want to give away too much about the book. I will say that they were arrested in Paris eventually, and the French did refuse to extradite them to the U.S. They saw the hijacking as a purely political act in opposition to the Vietnam War. There's an exception to extradition treaties in that if you feel that someone's going to be persecuted for their political beliefs if they're returned to a country, you can deny an extradition request. And that's exactly what happened in the case of Holder and Kirko. The French did resolve to try Holder and Kirko themselves, and that actually is wrapped up a little bit in the end of the book.
Where are Roger Holder and Kathy Kirko now?
That's really the big question. I'll say that I met with one of them.
Can I ask you which one and what he or she told you?
It was Roger Holder. I met with Roger Holder at great length.
What's your best guess about where Kathy Kirko is now?
I have a pretty good idea where she is. I think that all the evidence probably points to her having resettled and melded into either French or Swiss society.
Brandon Carner is the author of The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. He spoke with Doug Gordon.